Today at Reader's Corner, Philippe Sands, author of The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. I'm Bob Custrow. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Otto von Vester was an Austrian lawyer, husband, father, and a senior SS officer, creator and overseer of the Krakow Ghetto, indicted as a war criminal for the mass murder of more than 100,000 Poles. Vester was hunted for 3 years following World War II. In his newest book, The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive, Philippe Sands pieces together in riveting detail Vester's extraordinary, shocking story. Given full access to the Vester family archives, journals, diaries, tapes, and more, and with the assistance of Vester's son, Horst, Sands writes of Vester's rise through the Nazi high command, his blissful marriage and family life as their world was brought to ruin, and his four-year flight to escape justice. Philippe Sands is a professor of law at University College London and a practicing barrister at Matrix Chambers. His books include East-West Street, Lawless World, and Torture Team, among others. He is a frequent contributor to the Financial Times, Guardian, New York Review of Books, and Vanity Fair. Philippe Sands, welcome to Reader's Corner.
So good to be on Reader's Corner, Bob. I'm very thrilled to be with you.
We are just delighted to have you. The book, The Rat Line, was just an excellent account of the attempt to bring a Nazi to justice. Maybe I should put it that way. But let's start with the very basics for our listeners. Help them understand what the Rat Line was.
So the Rat Line is the escape route for senior Nazis from Italy to South America. It came into being in about 1946 or 1947. Your listeners will know some of the names of the people who made their way onto the Rat Line. Joseph Mengele, the doctor from Auschwitz, Klaus Barbie, Adolf Eichmann, amongst others, all went to Argentina or Bolivia or places like that. And the remarkable thing about the Rat Line, as I discovered, I mean, it was already known but not fully explored, was that the Allies, the Americans, the British, knew all about it and, in fact, were sort of using it as a recruitment tool.
And let's get into that. That recruitment tool was because the enemy, the name of the enemy had shifted after the war. All of a sudden, it wasn't the Germans, it was the Russians. And when you say recruitment tool, I assume they were using them for spying and whatever else, clandestine activities against the Russians. Is that correct?
Right, exactly. So the war in Europe ends on the 9th of May, 1945. And at that point, of course, the Soviets are the allies of the Americans and the British. And that's the time when the famous Nuremberg trial is created and so on and so forth. But by the spring of 1946, everything has changed. Winston Churchill, you know, in Missouri has declared the Iron Curtain has fallen across Europe. And all of a sudden, a new enemy comes into sight, and that is the Bolsheviks, the Soviets, the Red Army. And everything turns on a sixpence. And all of a sudden, senior Nazis like Otto Vester and many of his colleagues become useful potential allies because they know where the communists are hanging out. And the West, the Americans, the British, want their address books. And this was something I stumbled across completely by accident once I began to learn what had happened to Otto Vester after he escaped, tries to make his way to Rome, and is hunted by an American agent called Thomas Lucid. Let me pause there and you can take over in the direction you want to take it, Bob.
Sure. Well, let's go back and help our listeners understand just who Otto Vester was during his years as a Nazi, as a German official. You might take us through that.
Well, highly intelligent, big family. Dad was a government minister and a you know general in the Austro-Hungarian army. Qualifies as a lawyer. Meets his wife, Charlotta Bleckmann. Marries her because she falls pregnant in 1932. She's about 24 years old. He's about 32 years old. And he goes up the ranks in Austria, eventually flees because he's been involved in the assassination of the Austrian Chancellor, Dollfuss, makes his way to Berlin, joins the SS. His mentor becomes Heinrich Himmler. And whilst he's there from 34 to 38, he goes up the greasy pole. He goes back to Austria in 38. His first job in the new Nazi government in Austria is to remove Jews and other undesirables from public office. 17,000 of them he removes. And then he's promoted personally by Adolf Hitler to be governor of Krakow. And it is he who creates the famous Krakow ghetto. And then in 42, governor of District Galicia based in Lemberg, where he oversees the extermination of 500,000 Poles and Jews. So not a great guy in the work sense, but a good father and a reasonably good husband who loves his family.
You have some pretty incriminating photos at Baknia, which I believe is the site of one of the killings. Over 50 men were lined up, as I remember it. Could you tell us about that particular incident?
What happened? So I, you know, I've known Otto Vechter, Horst Vechter, the son, for about 10 years. And one day he says to me, would you like a copy of my parents' family archive? All the letters, all the diaries, all the photos they wrote from the day they met in April 29 to the day my dad died in July 49, 20 years of documents. And I'm going through this material. And for the most part, originally I was interested in the war years, what he did. But then it was the escape that was, I think, even more fascinating. And with all of that material, I was able to uncover an incredible story. For example, December 1939, he's governor of Krakow, and he writes home to his wife, darling, I'm having a marvelous time. The Vienna Philharmonic has been, there's a lot of literary events, governance is going well, famous ministers are coming to visit me, and so on and so forth. But he says there's a little bit of local difficulty. There's a bit of resistance from some of the Polish opposition. And tomorrow I have to have 50 Poles shot. Now, when I saw that letter, I said to Horst, well, look, that's pretty incriminating stuff. What had happened was that two German officers had been killed by Polish resistance. And Hitler ordered, by retaliation, 25 Poles to die for each German. And that was why the 50 were chosen. Horst looks at the letter and says, yeah, but Philippe, you see, it says I have to have 50 Poles killed, not I want to have 50 Poles killed. And he uses that to construct a positive narrative of his father. So I dug deeper. I found out that the town where this happened, as you say, was called Bochnia. And then incredibly, in an archive in Warsaw, I found many, many photographs from the act of killing. And those are in the book. And when I showed those to Horst and to his daughter, there was, shall we say, pretty strong unhappiness. They're devastating photographs. His father, Otto Vechter, lining up, having had 55 Poles shot. They're devastating images.
Well, you know, I've often wondered how the families, the descendants of these Nazis, view their family history and how they conduct their own lives to compensate for the crimes of their fathers and grandfathers. And reading your book is one great example or an answer to that, because here Horst, who you mentioned, is a guy who has a very difficult time coming to terms with this. And maybe you can describe for us how you view Horst's views of his father. He's very defensive to the end, it seems.
Well, he is in a state of denial, I think it's fair to say. I came across Horst through another man, Nicholas Frank, who's the son of Horst's boss, Hans Frank, who was actually Adolf Hitler's personal lawyer. And the thing that's interesting about Nicholas Frank is he absolutely despises his father. He wrote a book called The Father, which is a vitriolic letter of hatred. First time I met Nicholas Frank, he said to me, you know, Philippe, I'm against the death penalty in all cases, except in the case of my father. He deserved to die. And that was the very first thing he said to me. Wow. Later on, as we came to know each other, he said, you know, you're interested in Krakow. Your own family, Philippe, was from Lemberg, where Otto Vechter exterminated your grandfather's family. Would you like to meet the son? I said, yes, I would. He said, I have to warn you, Horst Vechter is different from me. He loves his father. He thinks his father is a good man. I said, that's fine. We got to know each other. And of course, I came to know these two men with diametrically different, opposing views about their fathers. I think Horst's is the norm. You know, we were discussing earlier the silence of families. I mean, on my side of the family, if you like, the victim side, if you want to call it that, my grandfather never wanted to talk about what happened to him, his family, nor did my mother, who was born in Vienna in 1938. And I learned in coming to know Nicholas and Horst that on the other side of the story, as you've suggested, there was also a silence. But both these men do, in fact, open up, but they take different directions. And what's fascinating with Horst is that he is the only one of his five brothers and sisters who has opened up. And there's also now tremendous resistance from his from the grandchildren. There are 23 grandchildren of Otto and Charlotte of Echter. And it seems that one of the norms for people who've been through terrible times, and it's irrespective of where it is to go the path of silence. I think it's a protective silence. It's a silence of shame, but it's a common theme on both sides of the story. And now Horst has constructed for himself a narrative which basically allows him to get through each day. And I sort of understand it. I like Horst. This is the complexity. He's a decent person. He's not a racist. He's not a Holocaust denier. He's not an anti-Semite. He just says to me, Philippe, I loved my mother. My mother loved my father. My duty as a son is to try to find the good in my father. And that's in a sense, an honorable thing to do, except that he takes it to an extreme that I think is not acceptable.
You're listening to Philippe Sands. He's the author of The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. As I read about Charlotta, Otto's wife, it's hard not to put her in the guilt category. I mean, she seems to have enjoyed the luxuries associated with the various assignments that Otto had. And in fact, later in his life, in those years when he's in the mountains of Germany or wherever they were trying to escape prosecution, didn't she help him considerably?
Well, I think this is one of the great untold stories. As we all know, behind every person who's prominent, there is a partner or a spouse or a lover who plays an important role. And if you take, for example, the 24 men who were in the dock in the famous trial at Nuremberg, you ask yourself, what about the wives or the lovers or the partners? What was their role? And now we sort of know in the case of Wächter, because we've got the entirety of the documents. And for me, Charlotte Wächter is the beating heart of this story, because she's the glue that holds the family together, the wife, the mother, the lover, the daughter. She is the one who connects absolutely everyone. And she is completely complicit in what her husband does. There was a moment when I spent time with Horst, Charlotte's son's wife, Jacqueline. Jacqueline was Swedish. And she took me to one side one day when I was with Horst. And she said, you know, Philippe, you have to understand about Charlotte. She said, I knew her well. She was a Nazi until the day she died in 1985. And in the materials, you know, we've not only got letters and diaries, we've got Charlotte's reminiscences. And she describes this incredible moment in the spring of 1945. She's living in Zell am See, a small Austrian town by a beautiful lake. And the United States Army arrives to sort of liberate Austria from the Nazis, so to speak. And she encounters a group of American soldiers, GIs. And they say to her, are you a Nazi? And she says, yes, of course I'm a Nazi, proud to be a Nazi. And they say, well, we've been here for months and you're the first person who's admitted to being a Nazi. And I think she was proud of what they had achieved. I mean, it's shocking, but true. She did not, in a sense, try to hide her commitment to the Nazi creed. She defended her husband for the rest of her life. But frankly, what she also did is she filleted the materials. There are gaps in the materials, and I rather have the sense that some of the more incriminating stuff from the personal correspondence has been removed. But she filleted imperfectly, and so I, as a writer, have the joy of her contemporaneous letters, which leave some of the stuff in.
Well, there was one member of the Wächter family that did not buy in or in any way show a defense as far as this is concerned, and that's Magdalena, who you actually close your book with a quote she has. But Is she the lone Vester family member who owns up to this?
This was a very unexpected story. I met Horst Vester in about 2011, late 2011, so I've known him for 10 years. On two occasions over a 10-year period, he introduced me to his daughter. I must have spent 30 minutes each time with her. We never talked much. She didn't say a great deal. Then in 2018, in fact, the book started off life as a podcast. You can listen to it. It's free on the BBC. It's a 10-part series called The Rat Line. It's very easy to find. And after episode 10 was broadcast, I got an extraordinary letter from Magdalena Vechter, the granddaughter of Otto and Charlotte, the only child of Horst. And she said, "Dear Philippe, I've listened to the podcast, and I have to say, I'm with you. My father is wrong about his parents." And there began a new friendship, so to speak, and a new set of explanations. And the upshot of her reaching out to me is that Horst has now cut her off. He's disinherited her because she has not drunk his Kool-Aid, so to speak. And Magdalena, having reached out to me, as I describe in the book, the consequences that Horst has disinherited her, and that's very tough for me, I have to say.
Well, I certainly did not know that. That's a significant development in the family history, without a doubt.
Well, there are, since this book has come out, there have been the most extraordinary developments. Other members of the Vechter family have reached out. One other grandchild asked me whether I could publicly forgive his grandfather. And I said, "Well, I'm not sure that I can do that, given everything that he did. But why don't we go together to the Vatican and meet with a pope and a cardinal who have read my book and said they would like to talk about it?" It's a very Catholic family. And I'm waiting for a reply. But hopefully in the not too distant future, we will be off to the Vatican to have an effort at reconciliation.
So, Philippe, let's talk a little bit about those years after the war, 1945 to 48, when Otto does another one of his disappearances. Tell us where he spends these times. And as I alluded to earlier, we know Charlotta was involved.
Absolutely. So Charlotta is living in Salzburg in central Austria. And this, as many of your listeners will know, is a mountainous, beautiful region with lots of small, high-altitude villages. And what has happened, as I learned from this secret family archive, is that Otto, hunted by the Americans, the Soviets, the Poles, the British, the Jews, meets a young Waffen-SS soldier called Buko Rattmann, who is a high-altitude killer and survivor. He specializes in mountain survival. And Buko Rattmann says, "I'm going to take you to a place where we will hide together for 3 years, up in the mountains above 6,000, 7,000 feet, where the British and the Americans are too lazy and too stupid to come and find us." And that's what they do. They go and hide very high up, shepherd's huts. They spend 3.5 years together. Every 2 weeks, Charlotta, the wife, arrives with food and clothing and socks and shoes and newspapers. They follow the Nuremberg trial from their places of hiding. And at a certain point, I said to Horst, "Tell me about this Buko Rattmann. Why did he do what he did? Why did he look after your father?" Horst looks at me with this sweet twinkle in his eye, and he says, "Well, Philippe, I can answer all of these questions, or we could telephone Buko." So at that point, as you can imagine, I was pretty stunned. This was about 2017. So it is 72 years after the end of the war. It had never occurred to me that Buko Rattmann might actually still be alive, but he was. We telephoned Buko Rattmann there and then. He invited us to come and see him. And I spent a long day hearing directly from the man who looked after and saved Otto Vechter. It was one of the most remarkable days of my life, I have to say.
Wow, I guess. You're listening to Philippe Sands. He's the author of The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. Well, we all hear these stories of how complicit or not certain members of the Vatican were in the post-war Nazi era. I wonder if you could take us then from Otto's hiding in the mountains to Rome, where we now find him hanging out with, among others, a bishop.
Yep. Well, it's a detective story at this point, as you know, you've read the book. Summer of 48, Otto decides the mountain life is not for him anymore. He wants to head off, and he decides he's going to go to Argentina on the Reich migratory route, the rat line. And we know from the diaries and the letters the path that he follows. He spends a little time with Charlotta. He crosses the Dolomites on foot. I followed him with my daughter. I followed in the same footsteps. An extraordinary journey he made. He did it in February. I did it in June. June, I can tell you, was difficult enough. I don't know how he did it in February. And eventually he enters Italy and makes his way to Rome, where on the 29th of April 1949, he arrives. And he sends a letter immediately to Charlotta, saying, darling, I have arrived. I was met by the religious gentleman. Now, at this point, he knows he's a hunted man. And so all of the letters and all of the diary entries are in code. So for every single person that he met, we just get a name, the religious gentleman. And it took me and my wonderful young researchers 3 years to find out who everyone was. And we found out that the religious gentleman was an Austrian bishop called Alois Hudal, who is the same bishop who provided assistance to people like Mengele and Barbie and so many others who did manage to escape. He was an Austrian, Nazi, racist, anti-Semitic. The big question, which your question poses, is was he a lone operator? Was he off on a frolic of his own? Or was he assisted by others in the Vatican? So we've got some evidence that he got some assistance, but I'm very careful in how I write this because my own sense is that this was not something the entire Vatican was behind, the escape route to Argentina. It was a handful of Nazi-sympathizing bishops and possibly cardinals who came together. They may have had a little bit of financial assistance from Pope Pius XII, but even that is unclear and not yet known. So I think the Vatican story is complicated. I'm not an expert in that. I've simply gone with what I know. Bishop Alois Hudal was absolutely a central player. But what I did discover with the help of a fantastic academic down in Florida, Norman Goder, was that Bishop Alois Hudal was not only helping Nazis to escape South America, he was for 5 years a paid American spy, $50 in cash, every month, reporting to the Americans every Nazi he was helping. In other words, and this is where the real horror, in a sense, opens up, the Americans and the Brits knew exactly what was going on with all these Nazis. And this I got from a neighbor of mine, the late great writer John le Carré, because I didn't know about espionage in the Cold War, but my neighbor le Carré did. And I was astonished when he told me I was there in 1949. Yes, we tried to recruit Nazis. It was very perplexing. Mm-hmm.
So during this time that he is in Rome, he has a name, Reinhardt. And he eventually dies, of course. I wonder if you could take us through his death because there's this question as to how he died.
Indeed, he dies in rather mysterious circumstances. The weekend of the 2nd or 3rd of July, 1949, he goes to visit an unnamed old comrade. We now know who he is. I'm not going to give it away to the readers. And he has a wonderful weekend with the old comrade and his Italian wife and the young six-week-old child, who is the clue and the key to us uncovering who the old comrade was, another Nazi mass murderer. He goes back to Rome, he falls ill, and a week later he's dead in a Vatican hospital. Charlotta Wächter rushes to Rome, becomes convinced that he has been poisoned, passes that on to Horst, who runs with the poisoning argument. He's either been poisoned by the Americans or the Soviets or Simon Wiesenthal or the Jews or whatever. The other more prosaic theory is that he was a man who loved to swim. He got poisoned by coming into contact with rat's urine that was poisoned, leptospirosis, and he died. And those are the two theories. I end up thinking it more likely that he died from leptospirosis, sort of a disease, but Horst is absolutely attached to the notion that he was poisoned. And that mystery remains to a certain extent unresolved.
Well, just in case there's any doubt about his guilt, Wächter's guilt over the years, certainly Horst never gave up attempting to convince people that his father was a good man who was not a Nazi criminal. But there is a moment in your book when Horst sends out a letter claiming that his father was venerated in the region he administered in Poland, and that letter winds up in the hands of Dieter Schenck. I'll let you take it from there.
Well, Dieter Schenck is the leading historian in Germany on Nazi crimes in occupied Poland. Indeed, he becomes the expert used by the United States Department of Justice. You know these stories, Jemanchuk and others, guys who've come to the United States in the late 1940s from Ukraine and other places, and then word emerges in the 1980s and the 1990s that they may have been camp guards or other things. So whenever this happens, there's a trial in the United States, often in Cleveland, Ohio, or thereabouts, to send these guys back to Germany or Poland for trial. And Schenck becomes the leading expert witness in all of these cases. So I turned to him for an account of what Vechter got up to, and he was under no illusions. He was absolutely clear that Vechter was a mass murderer on an industrial scale. If he had been caught, he would have been tried. If he had been tried, he would have been convicted. And once convicted, like all of his colleagues, he would have been sentenced to death. So I am in no doubt, not only that Otto Vechter is a mass murderer, genocide, crimes against humanity, but that Otto Vechter murdered my grandfather's entire family. And in that sense, this book becomes, in a way, in a more literary style, the judgment of Otto Vechter that no court ever handed down.
Well put, well put. What role does the documentary film A Nazi Legacy, What Our Fathers Did, play into your ability to uncover Otto's role in the war?
Well, that was hugely catalytic. That was in 2015 that the film came out at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York City, won a few prizes, and went actually even in cinemas, played in the UK and the US. It's the story of my relationship with Nicholas Frank, the son of Hans Frank, and Horst Vechter, the son of Otto Vechter, and their different positions. And we traveled together to Ukraine. And indeed, I think you could say that the Ratline book and the podcast were the direct result of that filming. There was a moment where we found ourselves in the Ukraine. Horst had said to us, let's go in July because there's a celebration of my father's Waffen-SS Galicia Division. So we went and found ourselves in a large field and a sort of reenactment of the glories of those days during the war, with hundreds of people running around in SS uniforms. I've got to say, it was pretty shocking. And after that day, Nicholas did an interview on camera and said, you know, I think Horst could be a new kind of Nazi. I disagreed with that. But when Horst saw the movie, he was so upset by that scene. He said, how can I prove that I'm not a Nazi? And I suggested to him then, why don't you give all of this archival material, your parents' letters and diaries and memoirs and reminiscences, give them to a museum in Washington, D.C., the United States, a federal museum, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. He said, that's a great idea. He did it. And then he said, do you want a copy? And that was about 2014, 2015. And that was how I got on the material. So the film is widely available. It was actually shown also on PBS, public broadcasting. And it was the key. If that film had not been made, if Horst had not seen it, I would have not got the material that is the subject of the Ratline. It's as simple as that. Life is strange, eh?
I guess it is. And the name of that film again?
My Nazi Legacy, What Our Fathers Did. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking to you from France. Strangely, we went to a screening of it now. It came out 6 years ago. I still get requests to go to screenings. It's one of those films that seems to have a long, long life.
Well, one final question, Philippe. I can't help but think about this family and the many who remained silent, and Horst himself, who is defensive of his father. And it doesn't take me too long. I'm no expert in German politics, but it doesn't take me too long to wonder if there isn't a connection, vague perhaps, between those who are left behind and refuse to reveal the truth or see the truth, and what goes on in a country like Germany. Of course, it's going on in the United States of America as well, as people move to the right. on the political spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, between these two sons, Nicholas and Horst, Nicholas is the exception. The son who recognizes the crimes of his father is the exception. Horst, I think, is the more common view. And I think there are probably quite a lot of Horsts around. This came very alive to me just a few months ago. You know, you mentioned the situation in the United States. I don't know if you recall the extraordinary video released by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger after the events of the 6th of January in Washington, D.C. And Schwarzenegger put out a video. It's just 6 or 7 minutes. It's really worth looking at. And it's a pretty remarkable video statement. He basically says, look, I know about all these things. I'm Austrian. I know what happens when you cross a line and don't call things out and are in denial about what is happening. And then he goes on to describe his own childhood and the bad attitude of his dad, who shouted at his mom and beat the kids. And then he says, you know, the thing is, I know why my dad behaved like that. It was the things he and his generation had seen or had done. But it was curious that Schwarzenegger never actually says, what is the reality? My father was a Nazi. And I call a few friends of mine in Austria, and I said, why do you think he didn't say that? And they all said to me, to the man and woman, no Austrian will say to you, my parent was a Nazi. There's a sort of state of collective denial about what has happened. And I don't think that's peculiar to Austria or Germany. We all know that where terrible things happen, the next generations don't really want to engage in it. I mean, it's the same thing in Britain and the United States. You know, if you come from a slave-owning family, frankly, you don't go around, you know, bleating it out to the whole world. You sort of keep it under wraps until something comes out, and then there's mayhem. So dealing with a difficult past, I think, is one of the major themes that arises out of this story. And, you know, who knows how I would react and how I would feel about my dad if he'd killed hundreds of thousands of people. Would I love him? Would I hate him? I put my hand on my heart and I say, I don't know. I don't know how I would react. These are really complex issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, Philippe, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. This is a fitting conclusion to an impressive treatment of a piece of history that is too often missed by writers and historians. Again, the name of the book is The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. Philippe Sands has been our guest today. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us here at Reader's Corner.
It's a huge pleasure to be with you, Bob, and thank you to all your listeners.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.